Ladies and gentlemen, during the next half hour, you will, in a sense, be present at a meeting of shareholders. You yourself are one of them. One of many millions with a share in the great group of international organizations known as the UN family. At this meeting, no direct dividends will be declared, for the profits cannot be calculated in cash or kind. Yet we are met to declare an interim dividend of incalculable value. My name, by the way, is Melvin Douglas, and I've been invited to act as chairman.
United Nations Radio presents Current Account, a statement of recent, present, and planned action by the organized world community in promoting the peaceful use of atomic energy. Current Account.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention? Before we come to the substance of our meeting, it might, I think, be useful to ponder for a moment or two the nature of the age we're living in. We call it atomic, and we read, see, and hear so much about it every day that it's somehow become almost commonplace before it's even matured. Yet such a feeling is obviously absurd. There's nothing commonplace about this time. In all history, there's never been a time quite like it. 4 years ago in England, I heard the great physicist Professor Oppenheimer give a lecture on the sciences and man's community. And I remember him saying,
"The greatest of the changes that science has brought is the acuity of change. The greatest novelty is the extent of novelty. Short of rare times of great disaster, civilizations have not known such rapid alteration in the conditions of their life. Such rapid flowering of many varied sciences, such rapid changes in the ideas we have about the world and one another. Within a lifetime, what we learned at school has been rendered inadequate by new discoveries and new inventions. The ways that we learn in childhood are only very meagerly adequate to the issues that we must meet in maturity."
The changes and the issues. It's easy to speak of them, to philosophize about them in an abstract sort of way. But can we really grasp them and give them form and tangible meaning in our minds? Where, for the man in the street, are the opportunities to experience them as living realities?
2 years ago, in Geneva, hundreds had such an opportunity, every day for 2 weeks. It was the time of the now historic gathering of scientific and technical skill and insight from 73 nations, the first United Nations conference on the peaceful uses of atomic energy, originally proposed by President Eisenhower in an address before the United Nations General Assembly.
While the experts met in the conference rooms of the Palais des Nations, restoring in personal contact the traditional bonds of science which years of war and fear had made frail and tenuous, the general public flocked to see the technical exhibition staged as an integral part of the conference. One man who was there recalls the impact which that exhibition made on him. It's a very typical recollection.
"Of all the exhibits, I think the research reactor which the United States built in a special building in the Palais Gardens was the one which fascinated everybody most. The day I saw it was hot and sunny, and I had to stand in line outside, waiting to move in. I remember thinking, I'm going to see a reactor. Reactors. I've heard of them 1,000 times, but what is a reactor? What sort of thing am I going to see? Then the line moved, and I was inside. After the glare of the sun, it was suddenly dim, and quiet, too, except for the voice of a charming guide.
Now, the pool of water in which the reactor is immersed is in this steel tank here, 10 feet in diameter, 22 feet deep. The tank contains 13,000 gallons of water from which all minerals have been removed."
I walked to the circular railing round the pool and looked down. Most inviting. Like a beautiful swimming pool. Cool, clear, pure. But curiously unimpressive and uncomplicated. I was a little disappointed with my first glimpse of a reactor.
The water acts as a coolant, a moderator, and a shield against radiation. Now, down at the bottom, you can see the reactor core, that block of aluminum sandwiches, as they're sometimes called. This core is composed of uranium, enriched to 20% in uranium-235.
I looked down again, and again I was not particularly impressed. The sandwiches were crisscrossed, making a sort of honeycomb or lattice. The core might well contain all the mysterious force of the universe, but it still looked like a block of aluminum.
The reactor operates at a power level from 10 kilowatts to a maximum of 100 kilowatts. That bell, sounding in the control room to your right, means that the reactor is now on.
As well as the bell, a sign above the pool flashed on saying, "Reactor in operation."
Now you will notice that as the power increases, the reactor core will glow brighter and brighter with a bluish-green light. This is known as the Cherenkov effect, caused by the slowing down of high-energy radiation in the water with the release of part of the energy.
This time, I watched with a sense of awe and fascination that mounted with the growing brightness of the submerged light. Here, I suddenly realized, here in this strange, silent, and deceptively simple device is the new reality. Here is our age and the future. For the first time that day in Geneva, I grasped the full meaning of that short but portentous word, the atom.
This, then, is the essential nature of our time. Out of the silent, glowing heart of the atom can come a life such as mankind has but dreamed of in all the millennia of his history. But there is an if that everyone is aware of. It was stated recently in an article by a former member of the United States Atomic Energy Commission. He wrote,
"If men consent to act reasonably, and it is a big if, atomic energy can powerfully assist in creating conditions in the world which men commonly acknowledge to be at least the earthly conditions of human welfare. The advancement of man's understanding of nature, the improvement of human health, and the provision of a decent standard of living on a worldwide scale. These are authentically human purposes sanctioned by the high imperatives of the moral order."
And that, ladies and gentlemen, brings us to the substance of our meeting, to the statement of organized international action in Atoms for Peace, to our current account. It was in the desert of New Mexico, on July 16, 1945, that the first atomic bomb was exploded. The dawn of our new age was an ugly and sinister one. Almost exactly 12 years later, on July the 3rd this year, news correspondents at UN headquarters in New York picked up a press release. It wasn't a very dramatic one, and it's doubtful if any of the correspondents rushed to phone its contents to their offices. They simply filed it as a routine but interesting item.
"The Preparatory Commission of the International Atomic Energy Agency has completed its sixth session and has agreed on the proposed program of work for the new agency for its first year. During the month of July, the commission will move to Vienna, where it will organize the first general conference of the agency, which is scheduled to open there on October the 1st.
A 12-year measure of a change in climate. From the bomb to a new international organization, which in October will begin to put into action the functions set down clearly and simply in its statute.
To encourage research and development, to provide atomic materials for research and industrial use, to exchange scientific and technical information, to promote the exchange of scientists, to establish safeguards to prevent the military use of material it may supply, to establish and apply health and safety standards, to acquire or build plants needed to carry out its functions."
The statute of the new agency was unanimously adopted by more than 80 nations at a conference at UN headquarters last September. On On the opening day of that conference, the Secretary General, Mr. Dag Hammarskjöld, said this.
At the beginning of this atomic age, there was an all-prevailing fear that the atom, harnessed by man, would produce only disaster. The feeling is now justified that, since those first days, the world has made progress along the road of hope and confidence.
In October, the International Atomic Energy Agency will stand as a living, dynamic monument beside the road. It will be a monument, too, to the universal conviction that this newly harnessed force must, in the words of President Eisenhower, serve the needs rather than the fears of mankind. This is part of the dividend we have to declare. For the others, we must turn to documents and reports, to specialized agencies of the UN, to expert committees, to governments. Let's take a document first. A report for the United Nations entitled Sources of Energy as a Means of Economic Development, and subtitled Economic Applications of Atomic Energy. A very comprehensive document indeed. Perhaps you'd like to glance through the table of contents.
The demand for electric power in the modern economy.
Electricity in industry, mining, agriculture.
Major elements in the cost of atomic power.
Investment cost of conventional and atomic power plants.
Energy resources. Costs per kilowatt hour.
Radiation in relation to industry.
Transport of radioactive materials.
Radiation in plant breeding and agricultural research.
Radiation in food preservation and processing.
That's probably enough to indicate the scope and value of the report, though there's one section in it which deserves a special note. This gives a concise and accurate picture of present and planned atomic power programs in Britain, Canada, France, the Soviet Union, and the United States. It was possible to publish it because the governments of those countries answered fully and freely a questionnaire sent to them by the United Nations. They were asked to cite their experience with such problems as, how expensive is nuclear power? How can the costs be cut? When should a country build a nuclear power plant instead of using coal or oil or hydroelectric resources? Are reactors safe and reliable, and how can present types be improved? What help is your country giving to others in the form of fuel, equipment, technical aid, and training? It's impossible to summarize adequately the very detailed replies, but the report made this general and well-founded forecast.
By 1965, nuclear power will be making a definite contribution to the total electrical supply of the major industrial nations. In underdeveloped areas, its role will depend on many local conditions, though even now it cannot be disregarded in plans for economic development, and in time, all countries will turn increasingly to its use.
We recall some words by the president of the Geneva Atoms for Peace Conference in 1955. In his closing address, Dr. Homi Bhabha, the distinguished Indian physicist, said,
after the close of this conference, we will all return to our work, which in one way or another is connected with furthering the peaceful applications of atomic energy. We can do so now with the knowledge and determination that our labors will be directed and used towards bettering the conditions of life for all men, wherever they may be.
Only 2 short years have passed since those words were spoken. But our current account notes that in September this year, and again in September next year, there will be other great meetings of scientists, new fusions of experience from the laboratories and study centers of many lands. They are being called because, in Professor Oppenheimer's words,
the greatest of the changes that science has brought is the acuity of change. The greatest novelty is the extent of novelty.
The first meeting will be held at the headquarters of the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization in Paris. UNESCO has invited more than 1,000 scientists specializing in the use of radioactive isotopes, those byproducts of the glowing heart, which are already valued servants of industry, agriculture, and medicine, and may one day even lead us to an understanding of the life process itself. So numerous have been the developments in this field in the last 2 years that a new stocktaking is now necessary, a new appraisal of results. For 11 days from September the 9th, the learned papers and discussions will range over this broad agenda.
This conference will work in two divisions: the use of isotopes in the physical sciences and in the biological sciences. The first will cover geology, geophysics, meteorology, oceanography, metallurgy, and industrial research. The second will take up the use of isotopes in biochemistry and photosynthesis, human and animal physiology, nutrition research, medical research, and in agriculture, soil fertility, plant pathology, and the use of insecticides.
A bewildering but exciting panorama, which will broaden even more in just over a year from now, when the second Adams for Peace Conference opens in Geneva. It was in December 1955, just after the first conference, that the United Nations General Assembly passed Resolution 912, desiring
to promote energetically the use of atomic energy for the peaceful pursuits of mankind,
recognizing
the deep interest of all members of the United Nations in achieving this end,
noting
the impressive results of the first conference in facilitating the free flow of scientific knowledge,
and recommending
that a second conference be held under the auspices of the United Nations in 2 or 3 years.
Since that decision, the tempo of preparation has steadily quickened in the hands of a committee composed of experts from Brazil, Britain, France, India, the Soviet Union, and the United States. 88 governments have been invited to send representatives, and the provisional agenda is now complete. The Secretary General recently made this comment about the expectations which scientists already have about the coming meeting.
I myself, of course, cannot have any judgment on the significance of the new conference or the program elaborated for that new conference, but I can quote those very qualified experts who said that the program on which agreement was reached so quickly is a program which is more significant, more interesting than the program of the first conference. I think that is news indeed, and news which deserves all our attention.
It would probably be only confusing to go into the agenda here in any detail, but we'll select just two items. There is, for instance, Session E1.
The use of nuclear energy for purposes other than the generation of electricity.
Papers under this heading are expected to deal with actual applications of nuclear power to drive, for example, the engines of ships. Then there's Technical Session 2.
Problems of nuclear fission.
Here, we are in the midst of a startling possibility. A possibility of controlling the force of the hydrogen bomb, of turning it from a wrecker into a builder. A possibility that will, when it becomes a reality, give the world an inexhaustible supply of energy. This was the possibility which caught the imagination of all who listened to the discussions at Geneva 2 years ago. And as Professor Marcus Oliphant of Australia said then,
there is no reason why this process should be not realized. There is no reason in principle at all. But it is extremely difficult, in the sense that in order to bring about these fusion reactions, you've got to produce temperatures which are in the region of a million or several millions of degrees.
Since then, the search for the answer to the problems of controlled fusion have continued, and progress has been reported from several quarters. Let's quote just two.
In Moscow, Professor Igor Korchatov has obtained the highest temperature ever known by introducing, in a tube containing deuterium and hydrogen, a fantastically powerful electrical discharge which lasted only a fraction of a second, and which Professor Korchatov described as a solar fuse.
And this highly important discovery in the United States,
Professor Luis Alvarez, working with the cyclotron at Berkeley, California, has indicated that fusion is possible without resorting to high temperatures. Through a very complicated process, he succeeded in fusing hydrogen and deuterium into helium-3.
If and when this process at ordinary temperatures is perfected, the whole outlook for controlled thermonuclear power will have been changed. But as Professor Alvarez has said,
we are in the position of a boy picking up a penny and dreaming he is already a millionaire.
True. We are far from being millionaires yet. But this second Geneva conference, like the first and the Paris conference on isotopes, will pay dividends that will help us a lot along the road to that happy state. Which, ladies and gentlemen, brings us to the last part of our current account. It's the part most intimately linked with the moral conscience of mankind. It's the part which, ever since the first bomb exploded 12 years ago, has troubled the minds of laymen and experts alike. It's the part which, in recent months particularly, has given rise to a serious and sometimes passionate debate on this question. Is there peril in our progress? Are we, in pursuing and employing the innermost soul of all energy, endangering, if not ourselves, then the generations that will come after us? This account is not the place in which to note the views, sometimes contradictory, that have been voiced in this debate. Nor is it the place to go into the technicalities of the question of radiation. But it is the place to note, briefly, the efforts being made to study and determine what is true in this matter. Efforts to understand the dangers that exist, and efforts, too, to meet the new needs and problems which arise as the industrial use of the atom increases. The work toward these ends proceeds on both the national and international levels. United Nations agencies, like the International Labor and the World Health Organizations, are active in their respective fields. Take the ILO.
Even though, industrially, the atomic age is very young, it's already possible to see where international action can usefully supplement the national measures that must be taken to solve the manpower problems raised by the new developments. For example, radiation protection standards for workers must be drafted and applied with uniformity, and factory inspectors must be trained to specialize in this work. In fact, the question of training is a broad and very important one. Various new types of engineering and technical skill are beginning to be needed, and many already skilled people are facing the need to readapt and change their abilities. ILO can and will play its part in this great transformation.
And the role of the World Health Organization.
In some respects, our part in all this work is similar to that of ILO. WHO's program in this field can be summarized under five main headings. First, and perhaps the most important, the training I've just spoken of. Secondly, to collect and distribute information on the medical problems of atomic energy and the medical uses of radioisotopes. Thirdly, to study the health problems involved in disposal of radioactive waste. Fourthly, to work with other international agencies for the distribution of radiation standards, to recommend codes of practice, and to recommend pharmaceutical specifications for the preparation of radioisotopes for medical use. And fifthly, to stimulate and coordinate research on the health aspects of radiation.
Finally, and in the long-term sense, perhaps the most vital of all, there is the United Nations Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation, set up by the General Assembly in 1955 with this mandate.
To receive and assemble in an appropriate and useful form radiological information furnished by the member states of the United Nations and of members of the specialized agencies.
The committee, consisting of 15 experts from 15 countries, has been working unobtrusively ever since. Within it, seven working groups are collecting and considering information in eight different fields.
Genetics, effects of radiation absorbed internally, effects of external radiation, radiation from isotopes, natural background radiation, exposure during medical procedures such as diagnostic X-rays, occupational exposure, contamination of the environment by, for example, the disposal of radioactive waste.
It's a vast and vital field of inquiry, demanding great care, objectivity, and patience. It's an inquiry which could only be made by an international body like this committee. It could only be made with the wholehearted cooperation of every government on earth. They're giving this cooperation. And the dividend will be found when the final report of the committee is placed before the General Assembly next year. So, ladies and gentlemen, we come to the end of this account. How may we sum it up? Science and technology advance with giant strides. The prospect before us is at the same time wonderful and potentially disastrous. Much, if not everything, depends on that if.
If men consent to act reasonably.
Political and social wisdom and maturity must be the indivisible allies of technical progress. And perhaps in the light of the record we have placed before you, shareholders in the present and the future, perhaps this record is proof of dividends paid and of justifiable hope and confidence in greater ones to come. On the steeple of St. Margaret's Church in the ancient city of Gotha, there is a memorial anonymously inscribed in 1784 to the hopes fostered by and the achievements of the 18th century. Though a little premature then, they need not be unjustified today. This is the inscription. Hatred, born of dogma, and the compulsion of conscience sink away. Love of man and freedom of thought gain the upper hand. The arts and sciences blossom, and our vision into the workshop of nature goes deep. Artisans approach artists in perfection. Useful skills flower at all levels. Here you have a faithful portrait of our time. Look not proudly down upon us, should you stand higher or see farther than we, but rather recognize from this picture how, with courage and strength, we raised and supported your standard. Do the same for those who come after you, and rejoice. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your attention. The meeting is adjourned.
That was Current Account, a statement of recent, present, and planned international action in the promotion of the peaceful use of atomic energy. The program, narrated by Melvin Douglas, was written and produced by the international staff of United Nations Radio.